Yeah, the real challenge is reading the part where Mark talks about sin and understanding what it means. I've read a lot of time, I just never quite figured out what it means.
But I think that the more people, because when you use this kind of language, you think of it going away, when you are related to the capital, sometimes the additional overflow is not longer for you.
It's not long
enough. Longer enough for you.
Not productive.
Not productive. But I want to say that this kind of analysis helps to take into account the time, the bench, the distance, and also the system that you use.
But it's very simple
us
for the version.
Yeah, we're just. Like, I mean, because the thing is, what happens then, like today, what we're seeing with depletion of resources, for example. Although, I mean, a lot of, say, the price of petroleum is artificial. But say that that price actually reflected the increased cost of extracting and refining, producing petroleum for energy. How is this affecting the world economy? Well, first of all, we're devoting massive amounts of resources to just buying the stuff, right, and producing this and everything. So what does that do, again, to the free, to the profit that the economy is producing? Right. So what we have here is not just S prime minus DS prime. This is what you add here. This is what you, the same as up here. So you're diminishing S prime, but now you also have the added problem of the depletion of resources subtracting from your S prime. Actually, that should be added on down here. Also.
So
Because
the B plus D S prime. I thought that was the
Well, part of the DS prime would probably be overhead expenses, but the capital D is your overhead. But this is the DS prime simply is that portion of your what was your net profit, which has to be put back into the economy, which could take many forms, like Mary was mentioning. So the thing is, but when you bring into play the diminishing or the increasing cost of producing your raw materials, that alone over time will bring you to a point where you can't maintain the system anymore. Where you can't, yeah.
Like what she said, it's not that they're purposely putting money into useless things.
Yeah. Right. So you have all of these problems that you're faced with. So, under a successful form, now in this example, this is what we want to have, what we used to have. So a change in technology gives a 10% gain to C. Well, let K be that. So now, from productive process 1, represented by C plus V, the next year, after you've gone through your production, now, you're incorporating machinery, which gives you a 10% saving on your cost of production. Right. So, from in year one, you know you have for your whatever your C is, if it's $1 million, that productive process next year produces a second round of production, which only costs 90% of what it cost you the year before. So, because you've incorporated better machinery, so you're now saving money. So that savings in the capital cost of your economy becomes an increase to your net profit. Because you're now sustaining the same or greater production with less investment required.
What do you have to put the E guy?
So, you add your capital and your labor cost, should be greater than your capital.
Yeah.
And your labor cost minus.
Yeah, minus your savings of 10% in your capital cost plus your labor cost. That's, say this is year one, and year one produces a productive process in year two, which gives you a 10% savings.
Oh, okay, good. From year one.
Yeah. And then he says, so therefore, your S prime plus KS prime, which is this, is then greater than the S prime, which is related to this year here, right? Your S prime plus KS prime is 10% greater than your S prime. Yeah. And he goes on to say, so therefore, what you have, so your S prime plus KS prime divided by your C plus V minus KS prime. But year two, your ratio of free energy to energy of the system of production is greater than what it was in the past.
Does that mean the substitute agreement was based on the English and the
Yeah. Yeah, right. You're improving the means of producing things, right? And that's the, you know, in terms of the amount of what you have, you know? And that obviously makes more sense. Good. So then, if you have, so you compare now, say you have a third productive process. Now if S prime prime, so year three, the free energy, is equal to S prime plus that difference of 10%, plus, say then, or minus a thing that you have to put in, say for resource depletion, okay, to increase the cost of producing. And if C plus V prime is equal to V plus D minus KS prime plus CS prime, then, right, if your KS prime, that is your increase in productivity, is greater than the additional amount you have to expend to maintain your economy, then your free energy ratio production, the old one, will be less than your new, really your profit. The net profit will be greater than in the past, relative to what it costs to produce that profit. Saying this ratio here, which, okay, if the increase in productivity, if that increase of 10% is greater than the additional amount you have to reinvest back into your economy, then the free energy ratio,
that's year one.
Yeah, or the ratio of the net profit in year one will be less than the net profit in year two.
In other words, the net profit in year two is better.
Yeah. And even better, if KS prime is greater than both the increased cost, your increase of the cost for maintaining the energy of the system, plus the increased cost of resource extraction, then you're set.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. How could KS prime be greater than DS prime if it comes from DS prime? Like, where else would KS prime come from?
Well, K represents an increased efficiency or productivity of your capital stock. So that's what K is. Like, if you introduce a new technology which gives you a 10% savings, in terms of your maintaining your capital stock, that 10% savings in that translates into an increase in your net profit, your free energy. So if that increase is greater then the decrease you get from investing in expanding your system or maintaining your system, plus the increased cost of resource depletion, then your economy is absolutely growing or negentropic. Well, I think K represents a net saving. Well, I'd assume that that's incorporated in if you're saving 10% of your productive profit. But see, this is the interesting thing, is that, in fact, the whole idea of creating new technologies and making discoveries is that with something of a lower quality of production, you can produce something of a higher quality of production.
What Adam's asking is if the profit that you are making, if that is greater than the amount that you have to reinvest,
mm-hmm. then you increase your free energy.
Yeah. So that,
Well, it doesn't explain everything for me, because where else would KS come from besides DS? But it doesn't explain why KS would be greater than DS.
Well, for instance, like, say it costs you, say you're spending $1 million to buy a decommission. But that $1 million that you invest creates a situation where you're actually increasing productivity by 3%. Well, like, for instance, changing from, say, a coal burning plant to a nuclear plant. So you spend a certain amount of money to create a nuclear plant. But then the productivity of that plant would be any investment in these companies. The money you put in yields greater profit.
Definitely trying to indicate the increase in the overall capital cost of the depletion of resources.
But if you do
minus the money that the city no longer requires, but the capital intensity in the energy system is increasing by that years because of the part of the resources.
Yeah,
that's true. Like, when you go through the current study, it makes sense for people to, you know, that there's a grabbing everybody.
Yeah, it's true.
I would suggest that also, trying to maintain infrastructure and not just use the life, is also one of the most point of dimension.
Jason pointed out something that might help, that this should probably be a C. Right, because the savings in the capital cost, if that's greater than the increase or the subtraction from your free energy.
Well, that should probably be FU.
Or, well, he put it in FU.
Hey, I didn't write that.
You out here.
That's me.
Thank you.
Well, these are probably not. These are not brand new constraints. Yeah, sure. Well, Kerry's talking about it.
He also is doing. He takes into account the dynamics of the event. So that you have to play to know the event as well.
Yeah. Well, we're just. Yeah. I mean, this is not all of Arusha's economics. And I mean, these kinds of considerations are not even. I mean, these are fairly straightforward. I mean, even Kerry is really, although he may not have used these symbols, that's really what he was talking about, right? Or, but I don't know, was there any clarity on the, on your question?
I don't know.
Well, like if you increase the efficiency of production, such that that increase, that margin of increase is greater than any increases you have in the cost of production. If you save more over a course of a new business cycle, if you have more savings than you have expenses, then you have a net savings at the end, right? So if this savings is coming from improving the machinery you're using, it's like with a, I mean, you think of a mine. The deeper, like a coal mine or something, the deeper that you have to mine, it's going to be more expensive, right? If you got a bunch of guys with picks and shovels, there's not that far into the ground that they're going to be able to mine before it's just not worth it anymore.
Exactly.
Right, but when you bring in machinery then, where you increase their production, then you can start to mine deeper and deeper and deeper, and you can increase the profits. The profitability of that enterprise in that way. Maybe that's a more practical example of what we do. Or you think about this deep ocean or the deep sea oil rigs. I mean, those rigs are far more expensive to maintain than putting a rig in the middle of Alberta or in Texas. But it's the improvements in the technology of production that allow it to be profitable. Despite increasing expenses. Now, is that a bit?
Well, I was actually asking about the clarification.
Well, the point being, if the increase in efficiency or productivity is greater than the increase, like the increased expense, or what you're taking away from your free energy. What you're adding to it in the form of K is greater than what you're taking away in the form of D, you have a net increase, right? If K is equal to, say, 10% of S primed and D is equal to 5% of S primed, you have a net increase of 5%. Now, so it says under those conditions, then you have a relatively negentropic economy. It's expanding. In this case, a reduction in S prime. Yeah. K is an increase in S prime in this case, and D is a reduction in S prime. Okay. But now, if that increase in S prime, represented by K, is greater than both, the reduction in S prime represented by D, and really the further reduction in S prime. Represented by FU, which is the depletion of your resources or the increased cost of producing, then you're set. Then you're all set.
Yeah.
So, over time, the FU will increase naturally.
Yeah, so you're going to always have. Yeah. And that's the point, really, is you can't escape technological progress. And the.
Because that's the only way your pay can increase. So that you.
You think about it, the history of man's development is just constantly being confronted with boundaries and with limits and barriers to our continued growth and progress. So the whole task is to overcome those barriers, but that's what our minds are for. That's why we don't have this S-curve that the environmentalists talk about. That S-curve might become true if we don't increase our technology, but the S-curve itself is not prohibiting us from from actually increasing the level of technology in the economy.
The S-curve being
It's this thing that, you know, if you get an animal population, you'll say, okay, well, say you take an island and you throw some rabbits on it. You know, they start up from a population which is very low, and they'll increase. But there's some kind of upper limit on how many can be supported off of that territory. Then they'll hit it, and then they'll collapse, and then they'll hit it, they'll collapse. So that's the S-curve. So it's then they're caught in this perpetual cycle of population growth and collapse. And that's what Malthus and these guys are trying to attribute to human civilization also, but without any proof.
And now I think we can see that for example, the U.S. economy, the S price, the net profit, I think it doesn't even, it's not even enough to pay the interest of their debt.
Right.
So now you're really big.
Well, that's just it, and I found some graphs of this. Because now, you know, if we look at these and we have a sense of, you know, what needs to happen to make the economy grow, what happens then when you don't do that? All right, so here you've got a few. These we have been published in EIR over the years. This is from 2001-2002. So the physical economy, U.S. manufacturing worker employment. So 1979, 21 million people employed in manufacturing. You know, and it, up and down. At 2001, it was approaching 17.5 million. Now, since then, how many jobs have been lost? There's probably been maybe another, like 3 to 5 million manufacturing jobs lost. Right? So you think about that. Physical, U.S. machine tools. That collapse. Now, if you notice, what's the relationship between the collapse of machine tools and the collapse in manufacturing jobs in between 81 and 83? Really, what was happening then? Paul Volcker, right? You
Reagan.
Can't. Yeah, Reagan too, but it was. I mean, that's. Look, you cannot produce anything at 20% or 24% interest. I mean, my father had a manufacturing plant that went under at that point because he couldn't do it. You don't make 20% profit in production. So how the hell do you borrow money, say, in the spring, pay it back in the fall, and hope to make a profit? You can't. So either you hope you're big enough that you can absorb the debt and try to pay the interest or something until the next year. Or, you know, if you're big enough, you can absorb the hit. But smaller machine tool shops, get hammered, you know, with high capital costs, right? So you see, and of course, again, 2001, well, since then, the auto sector has virtually disappeared. So how many machine tools? How many used machine tools? Spike in 97, yeah. Oh, that might have been... That was during Clinton, but I wonder
that's
what
the
that was.
Production in units.
Yeah, there's one which the darker line is the production units in the... Oh, production in constant dollars. So the value, I suppose. Although it's hard to tell the two
lines apart here. Oh, the thicker one is the production in units. And that's the one that spikes. Even though the production in constant dollars is no value. I'm not sure why that would have happened.
From 90 to 97, I would say.
Oh, wait, 97. That when they were... Was there a war going on?
Was it the Persian Gulf one?
No, but maybe in the Balkans? Was the Balkans going? That was a bit later, I think. I can't remember exactly.
No,
I was wondering what would cause a spike in the production machine tools. the United States at that point, other than a war. Yeah, that's true. They could have been retooling.
I could do it.
If it was just short term, like, I could play the big one.
Yeah. But it didn't. It didn't last. And of course, now, yeah. Since then, it's fallen even further.
I like the question. We were worrying about the situation for that in North Africa. Is that a
that there is a relationship there, yeah.
Maybe increase the amount of infrastructure, the productivity of the country.
Yeah.
But I have this question because, you know, we cannot make infrastructure for the infrastructure. Because we have some demand. For economic demand of infrastructure before we make this infrastructure. That means that we cannot go to the from anywhere, the low line, go to the city, but start to build the roads.
That's not how Canada is.
Then start to build jobs. I want to say we can understand this because if you look the American or the Western economy, this economy reached some level that we call the economy the steady state. The steady state, that means that the actual capacity is not used in efficient way. Especially that the machine that we have to use now, the labor force that we have now is not used entirely. So if we engage more infrastructure, this infrastructure will not have a direct effect. So the consequence of this is that because they not demand for infrastructure, so the employment.
So there's no manufacturing now.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we can have some economic explanation of this.
Well, the explanation that for that has to do with speculation, looting, the creation of massive debts, massively unpayable debts, and a policy to take down this manufacturing base. There might be a theory about a steady economic state, you know, once you reach a kind of nirvana where you never have to improve anymore, but I don't think that really exists. I mean, there is a deliberate policy to stop development. Right? But the other thing is, think about Canada, for example. This nation would not exist except for, well, what happened in the United States. The U.S. has not built a continental railroad. Canada would not have a continental railroad. But Canada would not exist if we didn't build a railroad across the country. So the thing is, were you going to wait for people to set up cities in the middle of the prairies before you built a railroad there?
Or do you build a railroad so that people can build
cities? Yeah, we don't have this effect.
That's what we really have to do.
I think the policy, the government policy, to be realistic. If there are some service to know what people want, for their well-being and so on. After this saving, you can decide to make a infrastructure. I know that Statistics Canada, if I remember, we make this saving each year to know the needs of people. The needs of people. So this can condition, that can have a conditional for what we cannot start by infrastructure, by how that people will come after to use this infrastructure.
But are you saying this is completely absurd. I mean, I just misunderstood you. Are you saying that only once people's needs are met that you can discuss?
I said that there are some causality, you know. There are some causality that you can start with infrastructure, people came after. But you can also look at the demand, the needs of people, and come with infrastructure. If there is not demand, if you make infrastructure, you may use this money to do more to correct some you can use this money to because I want to know that in economics we cannot do things just because we know that by investing in infrastructure we can ameliorate, we can improve the labor or the factor productivity, and then invest in infrastructure like this. Many studies have been done before. Cost analysis, cost and benefit analysis. To see that if this cost, the benefits that we have to engage this investment, the benefit is greater than the cost, or the cost is greater than the benefit. If you manage the two, you decide to engage some investment. Then we come with cost and benefit analysis.
But I don't know if any economist who has been saying anything in the past 30 years saying globalization was improving the world economy, that free trade works, they wrote that book, they've completely discredited themselves by being wrong in their economic forecast. And you know, I mean, there's countless examples of nations that actually did develop. But in the United States became the most powerful economic force in the world. The Transcontinental Railroad is one example. The railroads could never possibly have built that without the government assistance. There was no pre-existing demand for the later uses of the railroad served. Because people might not think about the eventual use of infrastructure. So instead of saying, is there a demand among people who are not economists and who don't know much about what the future will be like, you have to be someone who actually knows these things so that you can determine, will this infrastructure, because it is possible to waste money. If you built a high-speed rail system in the middle of, you know, nowhere in Ontario, that would be useless. But not only because there is no demand, but there is no purpose. Not only do the people in those cities not want to spend money, but you can think about what effect it would have, and it would be a big waste of time and effort. So rather than looking for the demand of people who currently live somewhere and what they have in their mind, you actually have to have economists who have an idea about where the world needs to be developed and about whether it will have a perfect example of electrification of rural areas. Same thing in the United States, the electric utilities, they did cost-benefit analyses. They all concluded that it would be a waste of money bring electricity to farmers. And none of them did it. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, 5% of farmers had electricity. So, you know, he knew that these energy companies were idiots. So he ended up giving loans to farmers. They built the power lines. They paid for them. They built the power lines to the power plants. They still bought power to the power plants. And they used an amount of money and electricity that nobody foresaw, because new technologies were developed that used electricity on the farm, whereas before farming was not very electric.
They found ways to make it work.
Because an economist does a study, say, well, are they even right? All of the power companies were wrong about this rural electrification. Building it was right. Take this food crisis in the world, for example, right now. We need to make more food. Now, I don't care if there's probably some people in the Middle East who aren't thinking about nuclear desalination plants. And if you gave them a survey, they would not write nuclear desalination plants as one of their main demands. I don't care. They need them. It would have a great benefit even if they don't know it. You know, some people there do know that. See, and you can't do too much crazy. what individual people want or demand right now? Who knows what they're thinking? They might not be thinking about 50 years into the future. That's the job of the economist, and we have to have more citizens thinking that way. But I mean, you can't wait for you know people to demand.
Well, you know that. No, you are right. But the definition, I tell you, because when you start this conversation, you start by the definition of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
You say that economics is the optimal use of what do you call
it?
No. The use of the limited resources
mm-hmm.
to solve
unlimited
spending.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that each government has its own consensus.
Well, he doesn't think that's what
I mean. No, I want to say that sometimes, because you want to, you say that this thing is more important for these people, you know, but with this problem, perhaps this problem is not more important than another problem that government have to solve another place. So, the government how to manage, how to allocate its resources, and decide better which problem to solve than this.
So the final question is...
So we can decide that this problem is not more...
So the main question in all of that...
You've got to think about credit. One key thing is credit.
It's
crucial because...
And also science, because... There's a scientific way to figure out which problem is the better one to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So are they being scientific in the choice?
Also, and no one should feel limited by the current budget of aid.
Yeah.
We can create credit. Sovereign nations can create credit.
Yeah.
Let your primary concern be the physical use of your people, your workers, your factories that you have in your country. You can figure out probably some way of getting them to be the most productive. If a lack of credit to finance a project that you know will be physically profitable, prevents the project from going forward. And that's a perfect example of how credit can be handled. By credit, you can't have a monetary
system.
So I think what Dave is also describing here with regards to infrastructure is a couple of things. Like the fact that infrastructure is developed by nations, by governments, different than your regular business transaction. All cost analysis will come out, don't do it, and yet it's still the absolute scientifically correct thing to do to build it. But secondly, there's also like a mission orientation towards infrastructure in terms of imagination and development and that one, so that you're actually creating a new reality in the future. So that
back in the early 80s, we published a book called The Ugly Truth About Milton Friedman. And in the back of it, we put in a few examples of the use of what's known as the LaRouche-Riemann method of forecasting and analysis. And that's really just using these very simple ratios to look at what was happening in the U.S. economy. And what they demonstrate is that from 71 onwards, and actually I think earlier, like from the late 1960s, already the rate of profit and the rate of growth was starting to diminish. And the point here is just to show, in 1973, you went absolutely negative in terms of the rate of investment into the physical economy in the United States. And it's never recovered from that. If you think about that, so your S prime has been negative in physical terms since, say, 1973, so 35 years. Right? And there's a relationship between that and the free energy ratio of the U.S. economy since 1970. Right, so that would be taking S primed over C plus V plus D.
So thus, you've been consuming more than you're producing in terms of energy?
Oh, the system itself, has not been producing enough yet to sustain itself. So that's why LaRouche will say that the economy in physical terms has been shrinking since the early 1970s. Right, so, in other words, he would also say that this
this process here, when it's declining, so you still have some net profit until this point, right? So you might be having entropic, but it's not. But it's only after this point that you're absolutely entropic.
So in monetary terms, I would assume that
the monetary. Right. Well, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. Now this is interesting. So this is another way of looking at the relationship, as you're saying, between the increase in the money supply and the debt, right? Because you're just having to print money to pay to keep rolling over the debt, and meanwhile manufacturing employment stagnating and decreasing, and corporate profits even. Well, of course that's after the tech bubble collapsed and everything, which has a certain factor on that. But now, this is interesting because I just noticed this today. Compare that with the triple curve. Mm-hmm. Neat, huh? Well, not really neat. It's really soft. But anyway. But you see how these relationships here seem to resemble something in the neighborhood of this region of the triple curve. This is for those who don't know, this is a forecast that LaRouche put out in 1996, saying that the pathway of the economy at this point is towards an accelerating collapse of the physical economy, represented by this line go downwards. But at the same time, with an increasing, an exponential rate of increase of the money supply and the financial paper outstanding. So in this case, the red line really represents derivatives, other forms of speculative paper, and the yellow line is the money supply. That's how I understand it, anyway. And that. Like the printing of money or fictitious money and things like that. But that he later issued another one, I think in 2000 or 2001, that at a certain point, the money supply would actually be increasing at a more rapidly than the amount of financial paper to purchase. And that's when you start to get hyperinflation. And also the rate of collapse of the physical economy increases. And we saw, this is really typified here by the looting of the auto sector. I mean, that's, pretty viciously. And now with the privatization of infrastructure going forward. So everything possible in the physical economy, they can extract profits to boost up this financial speculation. And now, since, of course, with the financial aggregates, well, all of this is vaporizing pretty much in some ways with the collapse of the real estate speculation in the United States. But, but the hyperinflation, that's what that's representing.
So now the financial aggregates, meaning that it represents that the value of the assets of the commercial paper, so the line is going really downwards.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think we're, in a certain sense, maybe we're beyond this, but of course at the same time, as the monetary system increases, you're still increasing the amount of debt because the money being created is just debt. So, yeah, that's the, if it goes hyperinflationary, I have a couple of questions about some of these things.
So that's the same system. What do you know, the important ratio between the fiscal economy and the monetary economy?
There's no what?
There's not a ratio.
There is, yeah. These are not three separate functions. It's one function.
Because there are some models in the economy called
Amplis.
Yes.
money, and also system, also in food, the increase, of the supply of money, then increase the amount of output, the real output. If this is affected by the economy agent,
I don't really put any trust in anything.
It's not possible to use this relation so that if you can have good prediction of the monetary system, so that people agents have good information, perfect information for increasing. This can have some positive impact on the real economy.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if your credit, in the sense of if your credit system is designed to increase and improve the investment and improve the physical economy, yeah, there's a relationship, sure. But it depends on how the money is spent and how the monetary system is regulated. Well, this is also, reminiscent of the triple curve. These are just a few graphs of the U.S. household debt and other forms of debt. Now, this is interesting here. Right? This is 2001. This is before the real explosion of the housing bubble. Look, they're already, in 2001, paying as much or more in interest on homes than the actual capital. Right, that's debt farming. That's just hardcore usury. So, we can go through these quickly. Again, you've got the same. It's the same thing. It's a exponential or hyperbolic curve.
Crazy.
That's really what you see.
The true hockey stick.
Yeah. Total U.S. debt. And again, 2001. Well, it's probably over $50 trillion now. Pretty easily, I would say. That is a lot of money. That's bigger than the entire world economy. It's what? It's like five times the so-called GDP of the U.S. economy.
It's like $10 billion of the U.S. GDP.
It's between 10 and 12. $10 to $12 trillion. But what's interesting here, right? Is now maybe it's not such a good idea to be increasing the GDP because every time you increase it, you create another $5 of debt. Right? And that's one of the funny things. Again, why GDP? Why money is not a good way to measure economy? Yeah, see you later. Because in the terms of money, I mean, there's no difference between prostitution and railroads. What's the physical value of a blowjob? again,
political
capital. So debt service, the same kind of. That's wild, huh? Over $7 trillion just in.
Okay, what does debt servicing mean exactly?
Well, principal repayment plus interest. So the repayment of. Reading is a great thing.
Great.
Yeah, no, that's debt service. That's massive. Out of an economy, okay, think about that. That's almost the entire GDP of the United States is required to simply pay the debt and hopefully pay down some of the debt, but obviously they're not doing that because the debt keeps going up.
Thank God China keeps buying treasuries.
Boy, oh boy. And now, the U.S. Federal Reserve, a lot of those stats come from the Federal Reserve itself, right? So it shows you.
They've got all the information. Capable of doing this.
So obviously, I mean, this is why LaRouche is talking about this crisis, and that there's no monetary solution to this.
Because as we saw earlier, right? Like, think about this. George Bush and his stimulus package, all he did was created more debt. Right? So you go and you tell people are going to spend their $600 to buy some more crap that they don't need. Or probably, you know, probably most of those people are going to take that money and use that to pay off the next month's mortgage. And then that's it. Right? And then, yeah, hoping to get the big score. Well, fortunately, the world is not the way that the economists, most economists say. Now, this is fun because, you know, with the work in science that we're doing, this term of negentropy, or I guess LaRouche now refers more to anti-entropy, because he wants to distinguish from simply, you know, more from the laws of thermodynamics. You know, because most people today, what they're thinking of when they think about economy or the universe in general, the way that they're thinking is being shaped by these laws of thermodynamics, three laws. Number one, in any process, the total energy of the universe remains the same. Two, the entropy of an isolated system not in equilibrium will tend to increase over time, approaching a maximum value at equilibrium. Three, as temperature approaches absolute zero, the entropy of a system approaches a constant minimum. The one we're really interested in is two. And actually one. You know, I was thinking about this, but what is the problem? What underlies these laws, which is demonstrably false?
System.
Here's something. Look at number one. The total energy of the universe remains the same. So there's some kind of fixed amount of energy in the universe. And when I was just looking briefly at these, and, you know, you can find various comments attached to these laws and theories that people had. But, you know, it really comes out of Newton. And if you look at Newton's Principia Mathematica, what he says right at the beginning, says a couple of things. Number one, there is absolute space, independent of time. And there's also absolute time, which is independent of space.